Neil Black was the oboist, Graham Sheen the bassoonist, and George Malcolm played the harpsichord in Handel's early oboe sonata in B-flat. Join me tomorrow when I'll be fast-forwarding exactly a decade to 1717, the year of the composition of one of Handel's best-loved instrumental works, his Water Music.
Donald MacLeod, Composer of the Week, was produced in Cardiff by Stephen Rajam. Good evening from me, John Shea, with you this Monday evening on Radio 3, and later tonight, the first of this summer's Lebrecht interviews. Norman is in conversation with the conductor Gustavo Dudamel at 9.45 this evening. Before that, on BBC Radio 3, with the time at just after 7:30, we go live to the Royal Albert Hall for this evening's prom. It's presented by Katie Derham.
The first of several proms this season, celebrating exceptional young musicians. As the weeks go by, we'll be hearing from all our homegrown youth orchestras, including the National Youth Jazz Orchestra, the National Youth Big Band, as well as a specially created Proms Youth Chorus. But tonight, we have got the cream of the crop from both sides of the Atlantic, as the orchestra of the Royal Academy of Music sits side by side with that of the Juilliard School from New York. They're being conducted by one of the most exciting living composers, the American John Adams, in a dazzling, technically demanding programme of Respighi, Ravel, and John Adams' own work, City Noir. It struck me there were cinematic and jazz themes running through the evening, and I put that to John Adams earlier.
There is, and there's also a city theme. The Respighi, of course, is Rome. Rome in, you know, different epochs that opens with this really kind of terrifying evocation of the gladiators and the Circus Maximus, and then it moves to the pilgrims voyaging to the Holy City, and then there are these wild last two movements where it's a kind of a Mardi Gras a festival, the Autobrata and the Epiphany Festival. The Ravel feels very New York, Paris. It feels like, you know, he had gone to New York, he'd met Gershwin, he'd heard the Rhapsody in Blue, and it has that wonderful Gallic take on jazz. And then, of course, my piece is Los Angeles. That zip code.
Well, it certainly promises to be a high-energy concert. As John told me earlier, bit of a pun coming, standing conducting this talented and energetic young orchestra, who you can hear tuning up, is going to be a short ride in a fast machine, referring, of course, to one of his most famous works. Well, we have two leaders for the combined orchestral forces of the Juilliard and the Royal Academy of Music this evening, and in the first half of the prom tonight, the leader will be the homegrown Charlotte Reed, and then after the interval, her place will be taken by Korean-American Fabiola Kim from the Juilliard. And we'll be expecting Charlotte on the stage any minute now. Roman Festivals, of course, the third of Respighi's Roman trilogy, and they're always great favourites with youth orchestras. Lots of colour, lots of vitality, and lots for everyone to do. But that round of applause is for Charlotte Reed, coming to take her bow, leading the combined orchestra of the Royal Academy and the Juilliard this evening, for the first half at least. And I suspect that we're now going to be awaiting the arrival of John Adams, the composer of City Noir that we'll be hearing in the second half, and the conductor of the whole prom tonight. Yes, he's making his way to the stage, dapper as ever in a white tux, coming to take his bow and to conduct the orchestras of the Royal Academy of Music and the Juilliard in Respighi's Roman Festivals. Wonderful, energetic playing by the orchestras of the Royal Academy of Music and the Juilliard School. That was Respighi's Festivals of Rome, the third in his Roman trilogy. The first two parts, The Fountains of Rome and The Pines of Rome, perhaps slightly better known, but my goodness, what an enjoyable piece that Festivals is. Vibrant playing from this young orchestra, and you really can feel the appreciation and the applause here. And you can see and feel the warmth of affection all these young people have for John Adams, the conductor who's coming back onto stage now to take another bow. He's just brought the leader, Charlotte Reed, to her feet to take a separate round of applause. And the mandolin player, David Massey. He had his big moment there. John Adams bringing a number of the soloists and principal players to their feet. There must be, more than 100 people on stage, all of them worthy of a cheer, but some of them getting a little bit more of a moment in the spotlight. An extensive brass section on their feet now. And the whole orchestra, beaming from ear to ear. I overheard a lot of them backstage saying how much they really enjoyed playing this Respighi, and I think you could sense that in the performance we've just heard. If you'd like to read more about this piece and the rest of the programme tonight, I should just tell you, if you go to the BBC Proms website, you can get all the Proms programme notes on that website 30 minutes before batten up, if you like, and they're really worth having a read, actually. They're all the programme notes that you get here in the hall, but you can get them free online, and they are, they're the best in the business. But you can probably tell that there's something going on in the background. The applause has stopped. It is time for the stage to be reset so that we can travel from Rome to Paris next, and Ravel's wonderfully jazz-influenced piano concerto in G. It's been described as an Art Deco piece, very much the product of the late 1920s when it was written. Lots of allusions to the popular music of the day. Now, Ravel said the music of a concerto should, in my opinion, be light-hearted and brilliant and not aim at profundity or dramatic effects. It's interesting, though, that at the same time he was writing his piano concerto for left hand, which arguably reaches for profundity and drama in a way that this rather cheerful work doesn't. It rather feels if perhaps, emotionally at any rate, this was something of light relief for Ravel. Well, tonight we're going to hear it performed by Imogen Cooper, internationally renowned as one of the finest pianists of her generation, lauded, garlanded as a wonderful interpreter of the classical and romantic repertoire. She's a real lover of chamber music and duet playing. She'll actually be performing duo recitals with Paul Lewis next year, and she also happens to have spent much of her youth in Paris, which gives her a very particular insight into this Ravel, as she told us earlier.
It's absolutely wonderful. It's a piece that demands a lot of energy from everybody. And the great thing about players of this age is that everyone, back to every last desk, is longing to play. I mean, you know, in the greatest orchestras in the world, there's always maybe 20% of them who've known it all, seen it all, done it all, and perhaps are 5 years away from retirement. Not here. They haven't known it all, seen it all, and they certainly haven't yet done it all. So they're keen as mustard. And this particular youthful energy, rather wild but also very beautiful, is exactly what's needed for this work. When I worked in Paris as a teenager, one of my teachers was Yvonne Lefebure, who had a long pedigree of wonderful teachers going back to Ravel. She played this piece a lot. Indeed, she played it at the proms. And it was one of her strongest pieces. And she had fantastic clarity of articulation and also great simplicity of expression. She didn't milk the slow movement as one can sometimes hear it milked. She played it rather purely, and played entirely on colour and not on swinging the rhythm too much. And although I didn't actually work on this work with her, I remember that in her interpretation. If you're listening to this piece for the first time, you'll be struck by various elements. The jazzy element, which I must say was great fun. We've just done it in New York in Lincoln Center. Lincoln Center was built on the plot where West Side Story was filmed. So you could sort of feel the jazzy bits coming out through the earth. It was wonderful. So there's that. It is basically a virtuosic, neoclassical bit of chamber music. There are solos all over the place, down to the triangle. Everybody is very exposed and has much to do, particularly, obviously, in woodwind and brass. And I'm only a prima inter pares, you can say. And this brings a very tight, very beautiful, rather translucent colour to the whole work. There are some exceptional things about it. The opening of the slow movement where the piano has a long solo just sort of dreaming by itself. And the orchestra then join in the most wonderful way. And the theme of that slow movement is taken over by the cor anglais, who I accompany for about 4 pages. It's wonderful. It's got a very special atmosphere, this work. The piece is beautifully written for the piano. You have to be alert and cool, and your fingers have to be able to move fast. But that aside, it's a wonderful virtuosic piece to play, but it's also a great joy to play, and it's like a glass of champagne, really.
Lovely image. And you may be interested to know that to achieve that chamber music feel, the piano is, as we speak, being positioned right at the back of the stage, so that, or certainly nearer to the woodwind, just so that she can hear everything that's going on and they can get that feeling of lots of soloists working together in that chamber music fashion. Well, John Adams himself can't speak highly enough of Imogen's playing. They've been rehearsing with the two orchestras for the past fortnight, and as Imogen Cooper just said, they gave a concert in New York last week.
We had the blessing of Imogen Cooper just dropped in our lap, and it's been an amazing experience, both for Imogen to work with these talented kids, and then, of course, for the kids to just kind of get by osmosis the incredible artistry and sensitivity and vibrancy of Imogen's playing.
Imogen's going to be playing the Ravel Piano Concerto for us this evening. What is it about her playing that makes her such a particularly wonderful Ravel player?
I think what strikes me is the sincerity of her playing. You know, it's easy with Ravel, and particularly with this piece, to kind of gush, you know, to push and pull and sort of turn it into something that looks like it has too much stage makeup on. But she has just the right intuition about, you know, how much of a retard to make or how to turn phrases, and particularly the very touching second movement that always reminds me of the young Marcel Proust waiting for his mama to come and give him a kiss. There's just this very poignant kind of bittersweet melancholy to the playing, and she just plays that with the utmost clarity, and as I say, it's a sincerity that really touches me.
Well, for the young people in this combined orchestra, rehearsing and performing with John and with Imogen has been simply unforgettable. And one of those young people spoke to me earlier. It's tuba player Matt Blunt.
I'm Matthew Blunt, and I play tuba in the Academy Orchestra. For me, it involves the opportunity to go across to the States and join with an internationally renowned music college and play in all our different styles. As an English player, we tend to play a little bit more rounded in our style, less straight than the Americans, who have a slightly more direct sound.
And what's it been like playing for John Adams?
Absolutely brilliant, especially his conducting style, his rehearsal style with the students. He's so energetic, so enthusiastic. It's exactly what we love to have as a student orchestra.
Tell us a little bit how it works with the merging of the two orchestras, just the politics of that. How's that been?
Well, obviously, American and English people obviously have very different approaches to life. But the good thing is they're from New York, we're from London. They're two very similar cities. They're very different out there. They're very, very friendly, very much more open to showing you everything, whereas in London, you sometimes get that tube face where... You can spot the Americans amongst the Londoners as the people who smile, some kind of thing.
Nicely put by Matt Blunt there. And now Imogen Cooper is taking to the stage to perform Ravel's Piano Concerto in G, and she's followed by the conductor, John Adams, performing with those merged orchestras of the Juilliard and the Royal Academy.
Thank you. Thank you.
Like a glass of champagne. That was how soloist Imogen Cooper described Ravel's Concerto in G major. What a wonderful performance from her. She's acknowledging the cheers. Now she's shaken the hand of the leader, Charlotte Reed, and of course of the conductor, John Adams. You know, it's worth remembering that for all its lightheartedness and fizziness, this concerto requires exceptional virtuosity from the soloist. You know, it didn't matter how hard he practiced, he spent hours trying to get his hands around it, but Ravel himself could not play this concerto to his satisfaction. He had to bow out at the 11th hour and get another soloist to premiere the work. But Imogen Cooper, spine-tingling playing in that second movement as well, wasn't it? And as she would wish, we should also give credit to her co-soloists in that second movement. Piccolo player Douglas de Vries, Chloe Greenwood playing the cor anglais, bassoon player Jonathan Davis. Huge talent in the woodwind section of this young orchestra. And Imogen coming back on to take another bow. Big smiles, lots of applause from the players. They've thoroughly enjoyed working with her this past fortnight. What a treat, eh? If you'd like to know more about this particular work, the Ravel we've just heard, Tom Service has recorded the Proms Music Guide, which you may have heard already today on Radio 3. If not, you can download it from the website. And if you're really keen on finding out more about Ravel, as John and Imogen come back on to more cheers from the audience, there's a Discovering Music for both of the Ravel piano concertos on the website, plus an extended interview with John Adams as well, which Donald MacLeod did, the composer of the week. So do have a nosy around the website. So many little gems there for you to find. John Adams and Imogen Cooper, hand in hand, bowing again, having brought the rest of the orchestra to their feet. There was a lovely moment just at the end of the second movement when John just turned to Imogen and looked at the rest of the orchestra and just gave a little nod just to acknowledge how exquisitely they played that slow movement. But now as the soloist, the conductor, leaves the stage for, I think, the final time, it is now time for the interval, and we can bring you highlights of a Proms Plus talk which took place earlier this evening, given by the heads of Juilliard and the Royal Academy of Music, and presented by Louise Fryer.
Welcome to the Royal College of Music and this Proms Plus intro to tonight's concert that sees the orchestras of two equally august musical institutions, London's Royal Academy of Music and New York's Juilliard School, unite under the baton of John Adams. And I'm joined by one of the members of the orchestra, the leader of the Juilliard Orchestra, Fabiola Kim, the provost and dean of Juilliard, Ara Guza-Lehman, and the principal of the Academy, Jonathan Freeman Atwood, to find out more about their collaboration. Let's welcome them now. Let's start off by hearing, before I turn to any of you, how the joint orchestra performed in their concert when they were last here at the Proms. Of Berlioz's Symphonie Fantastique. Jonathan, does that bring back memories for you?
It certainly does. And actually, this last few days in London, the whole idea of bringing two countries together and all the different traditions and all the different personalities, and I think we worked out something like 28 different countries represented. There's this great sort of mélange brought together. And you don't quite know how it's going to turn out, which is part of the fun of it. And it's part of the great joys is seeing it take on a life of its own, and this has certainly done that.
Ara, let me take you back to the first collaborations. Where did the idea first come from?
Well, there's been a lovely history of collaborations between the two schools now, dating back 30 and more years. But initially, they were straightforward student exchanges, one-to-one trades. In the last 10 years, thanks to the leadership of Curtis Price before Jonathan and now Jonathan and Joseph Polisi, the president of Juilliard, I think the plans have become more and more ambitious. And so there have been a variety of exchanges, one on new music, a joint recording, the proms you just mentioned. Last year, a thrilling, thrilling collaboration with the joint commission by both schools of a new opera by Peter Maxwell Davies, written specifically for young people and with a plot line or multiple plot lines involving young people. And this is just the most recent of the collaborations. There's a very natural and easy dialogue between us. I joke that we speak the same language, and of course it's literally true, but far beyond that, it's sort of philosophically true as well. There's a wonderful meeting of the minds between the two schools.
Now, you've worked with some very significant, eminent conductors and composers. You mentioned Peter Maxwell Davies. Colin Davis was conducting last time you were here at the Proms. How do you go about engaging such people? Are they interested in taking part with students?
I think you start with a clean sheet of paper, actually. And I think you, I mean, when Joseph and Ara and I started talking about this with Roger Wright, we thought about something we wouldn't normally do on our own that could give us something greater than some of the parts, would have a particular zing, a kind of character that would emerge, as well as obviously the educational context being absolutely crucial to this. And I think we like the idea of something which would not necessarily be obvious in a plan of a proms planning year. And I think the idea of John Adams came about quite early on. And it was very much then building something, if we had Adams, then let's do some Adams. And that also fitted in very much to the idea that we'd done a Peter Maxwell Davies opera. Wouldn't it be nice to do some American contemporary music? And then I think it was the idea, we did go round the houses quite a lot. I mean, it was, I won't tell you how many emails to get to where we got to, but it was a wonderful process of exchange and trying to get a sort of theme. And I think we have tonight got a theme of urban city life in various ways.
And John Adams didn't actually go to Juilliard, did he? But he does have an affiliation.
He's conducted quite regularly at Juilliard in recent years, and we also had an enormously successful concert staging of The Death of Klinghoffer that John conducted at Juilliard a few years ago, which remarkably enough was the Manhattan premiere of Death of Klinghoffer. It had been performed at the Brooklyn Academy of Music, but had never quite crossed the river, and it was a great occasion.
And how does the college choose who's going to perform in the orchestras for these collaborative projects? Jonathan, how does it work here?
I think you want to choose people who will respond to the challenge and respond to the pressure and respond to the sorts of, the general artistic and technical requirements of the project. And that takes some doing, actually, because I think we're very fortunate in both our schools, both at the Royal Academy and at Juilliard, in that we could have filled all the seats three or four times. So I think you have to kind of look at where the experience is maybe going to impact strongly on the individual. You look across the year, and if you've had Colin Davis and Boulez and Sondheim or whoever you've been working with, and these great luminaries we're all lucky enough to be working with, then you look creatively at what you can divide up over the course of the year. And in fact, in terms of the division between Juilliard and the Academy, it's been absolutely wonderful because there are certain areas where each schools are particularly strong at the moment. You have a cohort of really good students in a particular department. And it just happens, I think, that because of the close connections and the communications between both our schools, we've managed to cox and box so that really our best departments are allowed to shine across the board. And it's come across at 50-50, really, isn't it, Hara?
It's actually literally split down the middle. Each stand is one student from each school.
And how is that? I mean, how is it playing right next to shoulder with your opposite number from the Royal Academy?
It's actually really fascinating. I was worried a little bit before because, as people say, it's two different schools of music playing, and we had never met each other, and playing in the same orchestra, it requires a lot of concentration and blending in, and it's a bigger form of chamber music, so I was quite worried, but even the first morning, I got to actually rehearsal half an hour early, and I was marking certain things on my music, and Charlotte, my stand partner from the academy, walks in, and she says, "Oh, are you Fabiola?" And from then on, we've been getting along very well. And as a section, we're very supportive of one another. And, you know, I think we learn a lot from each other. She would be doing a little slide here, and I'd be thinking, oh, I never thought of that, you know.
So it's an educational experience.
Yes.
And is that true for all the sections? Are there different approaches from the different schools? That's what I'm interested to know.
We were talking about this. Ara and I were having supper last night. We were talking about the various ways in which the different instruments have different approaches and traditions. I was quite surprised just the sheer homogeneity of the string sound. I mean, it is a thrilling string section. I mean, absolutely wonderful. I think John says that, you know, working with young people where you see right down to the last desk of the second somebody of real high quality just really going for it is not something you see in many symphony orchestras, actually, for all sorts of reasons. I think there are certain things in the woodwinds where there are very different technical production issues, and we were talking about double reeds and oboes and maybe bassoons to a lesser extent. And I think brass is very interesting. I think there is a kind of global brass approach, but having said that, you know, you can hear when you hear an American trumpet solo, you know it's American.
And are we going to hear that tonight?
We certainly are.
Yeah. I mean, presumably John Adams deliberately wants that sound.
Actually, I think we've got a Juilliard principal trumpet for the Cité Noire, yeah, deliberately.
So is there some competition, Fabiola, between who's allocated the solos in which little parts of the orchestration? Is it a kind of, oh, Juilliard's notched up, you know, 22 and the Royal Academy is only about 18, or is it all very evenly done?
I would say that it's very evenly done, and there is no competition whatsoever, really. Every stand, as you know, it's been said, every stand is a shared stand. It's for strings, and we actually, you know, hang out after rehearsal, talking about rehearsal. Our approach is to really learn something from your stand partner or give something and talk about something that, you know, you wouldn't normally. So it's actually been very, it's been just fun, you know.
There's been, this concert was rehearsed and performed by the joint orchestras last week in New York at Avery Fisher Hall at Lincoln Center. So it rehearsed for several days at Juilliard, and from the very start, there's been sort of the best kind of cheering for each other, the ultimate musician accolade of shuffling of feet or stamping of feet during rehearsals. Every time somebody had a really splendid solo, there'd be all of a sudden the shuffling of feet and within sections, patting of each other's backs. So I think there is a kind of real cohesive go team, go approach. The supply of adrenaline is very healthy in a young orchestra.
I'd like you to characterize for me, Ara, the sound of a young orchestra. What is it that makes that sound?
I think there is still the thrill of discovery and the sheer tangible pleasure. And in this case, with an orchestra that's not accustomed to playing with each other, the sheer pleasure of playing with each other. There's just a kind of glee and delight in music making that's still completely fresh and it's in its original state. And, you know, that's not to take away from the great orchestras in the world who bring years of experience and a different level of sophistication and insight. But there's something about the joy of music, I think, in a young musician's orchestra that's very tangible and audible.
that sort of indefatigable quality of a young orchestra. They don't know when they're done and when they're finished, you know, if you can always ask them to do more. And I think if you look at all the great conductors who work with young orchestras, and a large proportion fortunately do, I think they're better conductors as a result, because I think there's something in their game, whether they realize it or not, that they bring back into the professional scene that just reignites them. Even people like Bernard Haitink and Colin Davis and the sort of people that we're very fortunate to have.
Now turning to John Adams specifically. Now he gave the commencement address, I think, at the beginning of this last academic year, and he started out by thanking the students for having the courage to pursue a career in the arts. You've already performed this programme with him in America. How has it been working with him particularly?
It's been especially nice because we're performing a piece of his own, and in rehearsal sometimes he'd say, I don't know why I did that, you know, I made it hard for you guys. You know, or he would talk about things and we know what he really wants. It's always so nice to have a living composer. And at the same time, he's so down to earth and he's so friendly to us that it's not in any way an intimidating experience. It's just been very exciting, and he's been really good to us, and we've been learning so much, and we've been getting to know him, and he's a very, very important American composer, and for us to be able to work with him, we're very lucky and fortunate.
There was a wonderful moment in rehearsal. He stopped at a certain point and said, wherever it was, flutes from 38 to 48, just cut it, just cross it out. And there was a kind of dead silence in the room. It's this startling thing to be told. And he looked at them and he said, I can do that. I wrote it. And he said, it's always bothered me and now I take care of it.
Is there something good about working on a piece that's new to everyone in the orchestra? Is that helpful, or did you already know the piece?
I've never played, I've heard the piece before. I've never played it, and I think it was a very good thing for us, because as players, we were getting to know each other, the players from London, and if we were to play a piece that we know so well, we might have, and we probably would have had different ideas of how to play it, but we were in the same boat, learning a new piece, and so I thought it was very fitting that we were playing a new piece that most of us hadn't played.
I think also there's a sense that the integration of these styles and approaches we've been talking about may be a little easier this time, just on the fact that we're not dealing with 19th century music where the teachers of each of our institutions are saying, well, actually, you know, it goes like this, and the Brits are saying, well, actually, it goes like this. You know, with Feste Romane, it's only been ever, I think you were saying that it's only been done once at the Proms before, so most students, probably all of them, don't know that piece. Okay, the Ravel piano concerto is a different thing, and as you say, City Noir is not something that many people have played in the 2 years of its existence.
Now I'm interested, when a student applies to Juilliard or to the Royal Academy, do they all have the ambition that they will one day end up as a soloist? How do you manage that?
No, I don't think they do, because I think for a start, students are very much better informed in terms of what they're letting themselves in for than ever before. I mean, I think they see the profession for what it is. It doesn't mean they don't have dreams, but I think they have a real sense that you've got to be flexible, you've got to... I think they can hear that musical life is much more eclectic, it's much more available, and if you do listen to what's on their iPods, it's completely different from what I was listening to for my iPod. Well, there weren't iPods when I was young, but that range of music that I listened to was terribly narrow compared to what most students do. So there's a kind of sense that they can partake in a bigger menu of possibilities and opportunities. Having said that, I think they're aware that being a musician is a way of life. It's not just a profession, and that with that there are certain sacrifices, and one is that you don't get paid very well usually, and the other is that sometimes there's huge fulfillment, and like any other job there are other parts of the profession that can be a bit, you know, not so exciting. But I the feeling is, and I think, Fabian, we were talking about this earlier, weren't we? There's a feeling that if you know in your heart that this is the only thing you want to do on this planet, then you will do it, even if someone tells you there are only 10 jobs in your city per year.
I think also the whole model of how one becomes a musician has changed, and for my taste, in rather healthy ways. There used to be what I call the monastic model of conservatories, in which you would lock yourself away in a hermetically sealed practice room for a dozen years, practice the Tchaikovsky concerto to perfection, only to emerge to a grateful public showering you with rose petals. And that model happily went out a long time ago, and I think schools have acknowledged that. And I think we're in a time of flux, but because we're in a time of flux, there are many more avenues and much more room for self-initiated avenues into musical life, just in the same way that musical tastes and expectations are broader, as Jonathan mentioned.
Fabiola, is that true for you?
It is definitely true. Even when I was very young, I was asked this, I mean, I've been asked this question millions of times. People come up to me, my grandparents come up to me, they ask, do you want to be a soloist? Isn't that what you should be doing? But at the same time, even playing solo music is a form of, I think, chamber music. You play with a pianist, or even to your audience, you're communicating something. So when I'm playing chamber music, which I do a lot at Juilliard, or playing in orchestra, I get the same satisfaction and in playing basically any music, so I'm open for a lot of options. The reason really that I play music is we still all listen to music that's been around for hundreds of years, and we still think it's the greatest, so why not play it?
And what of the future? I mean, tonight is going to be very exciting, but presumably you're already beginning to hatch plans for new collaborative projects.
Well, after Kommilitonin, which was, as Ara says, was our wonderful co-commission of Sir Peter Maxwell Davis and David Pountney, who both directed and wrote the libretto for that, we thought this is going to be a hard one to trump. And of course, it was very nice to have this prom lined up. But again, we return to the idea of what is it that we can do that we wouldn't necessarily be able to do on our own, and how can we bring a particular challenge to these incredibly hard-working, talented young musicians both sides of the Atlantic. And we are cooking up a couple of things for the next 4 or 5 years. One or two or three, I can't remember, Ara, but
we have a big appetite.
Well, we're all very much looking forward to it as well. Thank you very much, Jonathan Freeman-Atwood, Fabiola Kim and Ara Guza-Lehmann. Thank you.
Welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall now for the second half of tonight's prom, featuring the orchestras of the Royal Academy of Music and the Juilliard, conducted by John Adams. We're going to hear John conduct one of his own works, City Noir, premiered in 2009 in the city which it describes, Los Angeles. He wanted to write a symphonic soundtrack to the LA of film noir, the movies depicting the rather sleazy life of the city in the 1940s, a time of sensational journalism and even more sensational crimes.
Tell us what inspired you to write this piece. Take us back a little bit through the history of it.
I was asked to write a piece for the Los Angeles Philharmonic to celebrate Gustavo Dudamel's appointment as music director, and this was his first official concert. And I wanted to create a piece that had something to do with California, so I thought that I would create this piece so it has some of the signal musical gestures that you know in this music, this kind of suppressed violence, the nervous jazz drumming in the background, the scurrying woodwinds, the saxophone kind of bouncing and creating these jagged lines, and then big brass climaxes, and then big lush string melodies that go way high up into the stratosphere and way down to the lowest notes. I've been asked whether City Noir is site-specific. You know, are any locations or street corners cited in it? No, I think it's really just the mood and the affect. You're welcome to imagine your own movie. There's one spot, which I remember Gustavo loved when I told him, that the first two movements are conjoined, so it's all one large musical structure. The last movement's called Boulevard Night, and it begins with these very slow evolving chords, and above it this kind of tintinnabulation in the harps and celesta and piano. And I said, well, just imagine you're looking at a city from a distance at night, and you see the lights twinkling in the distance. And Gustavo liked that. He turned on to that. But I think the fun of or the meaning of listening to symphonic music, as we do with Mahler, is not to be told what it is.
There is another lovely line in which John Adams says that this music should have the slightly disorientating effect of a very crowded boulevard peopled with strange characters, like those of a David Lynch film, the kind who only come out very late on a very hot night. Well, John Adams will soon be taken to the stage to conduct this piece, and this time the orchestras of the Royal Academy of Music and the Juilliard are going to be led by Fabiola Kim from the Juilliard, who you heard in that Proms Plus interval talk. And the orchestra tuned up now, poised, waiting for the appearance of Fabiola, and here she comes. Her turn to lead this extraordinary group of young, talented musicians. A true child of the Juilliard, apparently. Her parents met when they were students there. And now here comes John Adams, composer of City Noir, which he is about to conduct. A man held in great affection by this combined orchestra of the Royal Academy of Music and the Juilliard.
Thank you.
John Adams' City Noir, conducted by the composer, who's punching the air right now as he accepts the cheers and applause of this Proms audience. He's brought the merged orchestras of the Juilliard and the Royal Academy to their feet. They played out of their socks, didn't they? Great homage to the LA of film noir. You could just picture those David Lynch characters. Special mention perhaps should go to alto sax player Patrick Posey. He studies at the Juilliard. Amazing solos there. For those of you who possibly have been tweeting during that performance, a lot of you got in touch about his playing. John Adams coming back to the stage now, not just popular with the players, but hugely popular with this audience. He's someone who
holds a very special position in American music. He's been composing since he was 10. That's the sax player being brought to his feet. That's Patrick Bosin. John Adams now blowing kisses to the percussion section and to the rest of the brass section too. And the horn player being brought to his feet too. As I say, John Adams, he's always mentioned alongside Philip Glass and Steve Reich as one of the great American minimalists. He's been playing the clarinet since he was a kid, used to play in marching bands. Perhaps they're best known now for some of his operas. Later on this season, he'll be back at the Proms with Nixon in China. Great cast, including one of his favourites, baritones, Gerald Finley. He's such a nice man. He's now hugging all the members of the front desk, bringing what must be, what, 100 young musicians to their feet? But yes, his operas, which are Nixon in China, Dr. Atomic, The Death of Klinghoffer, they're some of the best known and perhaps most influential operas by a living composer. Taking political, historical themes and really bringing them to life. In 1971, he drove a beaten-up old VW Beetle to California, and he's been living there ever since. Feels so strongly about working with these young people. He was extremely inspirational when I was talking to him earlier. Absolutely loves the energy that he gets from them, and you can tell the feeling is completely mutual. Well, it is... has really been an exciting prom tonight. I do hope you've enjoyed it at home as much as we have here in the Royal Albert Hall. As I say, you can hear John Adams conducting his work Nixon in China on the 5th of September, and you'll also be able to hear one of his most popular short orchestral pieces, That Short Ride in a Fast Machine, at the Wallace and Gromit prom in August, which should be a riot. But now as the cheers continue and the general love-in on stage continues as well between the orchestras of the Juilliard and the Royal Academy and their conductor, the composer John Adams tonight, it's time for me to hand you back to John Shea in Broadcasting House.
Thank you, Katie. That was Katie Derham at the Albert Hall tonight, and we'll be back there tomorrow evening in the company of Louise Fryer for a concert by the BBC Philharmonic, music by Richard Strauss, Kaya Sarriaho, and Sibelius. In the first half, Anna Schwanewilms sings the four last songs, and the concert begins with Strauss's Also sprach Zarathustra. After the interval, the first UK performance of La Terna Magica by Kaya Sarriaho, and the concert ends with Sibelius's Seventh Symphony. Juan Comena conducts the BBC Philharmonic, and that's tomorrow night at the Proms from 7:30. As you may well know, all concerts in the BBC Proms are available on demand for 7 days after the live broadcast, so you can listen to them again via the Radio 3 website. And what's more, most of them get another airing in the afternoon a few days later. So you can hear tonight's concert again on Radio 3 on Wednesday from 2 o'clock. And meanwhile, tomorrow afternoon at the same time, you can relive Saturday night's performance of My Fair Lady. Well, next weekend, the music of Berlioz comes to the Proms.
The 2012
BBC Proms. Les Troyens at the BBC Proms. An astonishing score, the summation of a life's work in music and a work the composer himself never heard complete. The cast of the Royal Opera's new production reunites under the music director Sir Antonio Pappano in a concert performance of Berlioz's epic opera. Berlioz's Troy Story, Les Troyens, The Trojans, at the BBC Proms. Sunday afternoon and evening from 4:30 on BBC Radio 3.
That'll be presented by Donald MacLeod. Well, next tonight on Radio 3, the first of this summer's Lebrecht interviews. This evening, Norman is in conversation with the conductor Gustavo Dudamel, and that follows in 5 minutes or so. So before that, following on from Ravel's bluesy piano concerto in the first half of tonight's prom, another musical meeting between America and France. Aaron Copland studied in Paris with Nadia Boulanger in the 1920s, and these are four piano blues that he wrote at various times between then and the 1940s. Bringing a Gallic flavour to Copland's music, the pianist on this disc is Michel Legrand.
Thank you.
for Piano Blues by Aaron Copland, played there by Michel Legrand. This is BBC Radio 3 at 12 minutes to 10. Now, on Monday evenings throughout the prom season, we're going to be featuring the Lebrecht interview, in which the writer and broadcaster Norman Lebrecht speaks to leading figures in the music world. Here is Norman to introduce the first of his guests.
Gustavo Dudamel is the most meteoric musician of modern times. Winner at 23 of a Gustav Mahler Conducting Prize in 2004, he now conducts the world's top orchestras and is the youngest ever music director in America. During his breathtaking ascent, there has been no want of jealous mutterings and imputations of hype. Yet few who've seen him at work come away unimpressed by his musical impact and his educational zeal. This summer he opened the Olympic Cultural Festival in a deprived council estate in Raploch, Stirling, coaching children to play Beethoven. The son of two musicians in the Venezuelan town of Barquisimeto, Gustavo Dudamel became a protege of the economist José Antonio Abreu, founder of El Sistema, which transforms street kids into orchestral musicians. He took up the baton at 14 and 4 years later was named music director of the Simón Bolívar Youth Orchestra. After a 2005 BBC prom, he signed on with the Gothenburg Symphony in Sweden. 3 years ago, he arrived as music director at the Los Angeles Philharmonic, galvanizing the city with his extreme youth, Latino culture, and revivalist agenda. He's married to Eloisa, a dancer, and he's a pretty sharp mover on the floor himself. They have a baby son, Martin. We meet at an embassy in London following a series of concerts. Gustavo Dudamel, what have I forgotten in that summary?
No, nothing.
The colour of your eyes,
exactly,
possibly.
Exactly, maybe.
Knowing you a little, watching you at work, I get the impression that you live in the belief that music can change everything, yeah, can save the world. Is that an exaggeration?
No, no. I think the music have a very special kind of power in people. And you see the transformation can be a symphony by Beethoven, by Mahler, by Haydn. At the end of the performance, you can be changed, mm-hmm, by the music, feeling different things. I think music has a special
power. How does that work, Gustavo? I mean, you work with children who are literally God-forsaken. Nobody cares for them. Yeah. And you come in and you start playing Beethoven. How does that work?
An orchestra is a community. And in an orchestra, you have to play together. To play together, you need to have a discipline. To have the discipline, also you have to love what you do. The reason is the love to the music. That is what happened in El Sistema. For the transformation of the orchestra, we have all of that elements: discipline, the love of what we do, the access to beauty. That is such an important thing in our chaotic times. And then that transformation that the musician have in the process of learning a piece, of building an orchestra, building an interpretation, transformate directly also the audience. So it's an amazing interaction of what music can be, how powerful music can be.
I'm still not clear how. I mean, when one looks at people who are on the margins of society, mm-hmm, you get the sense that they don't value themselves. Is it somehow that the music restores value in their own eyes, that they start liking and appreciating themselves as they play, that they feel, I can do something, I can be part of something? How does the mechanism
but,
work?
You know, they get the position in the society, and it's not, you know, we think to have sometimes position in a society, you need to have money or to be famous. You can be famous in 1 second. But the thing with the music, especially in the effect of disadvantaged people, mm-hmm, you know, is...
Is that the term that you would use in Venezuela, disadvantaged?
I think it's the right thing. Mm-hmm. It's the right term. Poor people, we can say, people that doesn't have the access to life. Mm-hmm. One thing is to be poor in the material things, but to be rich in your soul, to be rich in your mind. When you change that, when you change that conception of poorness, that is not about the material elements that you need to have, your vision about life changed completely. And then you start to be successful, successful with your life. I always talk about beauty because our children, doesn't have access to beauty in general. You know, and beauty, for me, beauty is art. Beauty is the access to have creativity. Through music, that is what is happening in Venezuela, you really get a transformation in the life of the children. And they can live in the same place where they were born, let's say, very humble place. But they change completely the life of their family and their community. That is amazing because it's not an individual change. It's the change of the complete community because the community feel proud of them. They support them. What an amazing thing that in a place where music was not part of their life, music became a symbol of life. And that happened in Venezuela. Naturally, it's difficult to explain because sometimes words don't help. You have to go in to see that transformation because it's really so powerful. Mm-hmm. It's really something revolutionary.
I was struck by something in the body language mm-hmm. in Los Angeles in the winter when for the first time Simon Bolivar Youth Orchestra wore concert dress and they had been fitted for their suits and their dresses and they were walking through the streets of downtown Los Angeles dressed in these really sharp clothes and there was a swagger to them, but at the same time looking at their expressions and at the way that they were relating to each other, they were saying, this isn't me. I mean, this is the external, but the internal me is something else.
Yeah.
And they were more proud of that than they were of the new suits.
Yes, yes. Well, because it's still a youth orchestra, the Simon Bolivar Orchestra. Still people, you know, with 16 years or 20. Some of us, we have 30. But for us, it's always a challenge. It's a challenge because in the musical world, we have a preconception of what we want to listen. And for us, it's completely different approach because for us, it's something new all the time. To play a Bruckner symphony is like the first time for us. It's like to play the premiere of the piece. And of course, we have versions that we listen. That we have the access, you know, to listen and to see. But the approach to the interpretation, sometimes people say, well, but this is a Latin sound. This is a different, it's completely different because it's an orchestra that have been learning how to play the instrument first together, then to play easy pieces, then to go to a symphony. It's not normal, because when you play, let's say, in a professional orchestra, you adapt to the tradition of the orchestra. In the Simon Bolivar, it's different, because all of them, they are coming from the same school, and we have been together for more than 14 years, since we were 11, that we are together. We are talking about 20 years. At 11, we were playing easy pieces. That kind of approach to the music is a symbol of life for us. How music have changed our life in the most beautiful way is crazy. This gives a different kind of approach. It's never a routine in the way to play with the orchestra. Never. You can be playing the same piece to get, you know, maturity in the way to play, to understand. Sometimes we rehearse and we don't play pieces, for example. But we enjoy the process of the rehearsal because we learn. And the most amazing thing is the responsibility that the orchestra have with the society. What they feel, how responsible, how important is community. Look that we went to Rapploch to play this open-air concert. It's not an important venue for symphonic music. We went to the community and they were sharing with children. The level is completely different. Bolivar is playing Beethoven III, Alpine Symphony. They are starting. But the compromise that they have for us was an inspiration. We went back 25 years. Woof! Immediately it was like we were sitting, we were dreaming, we were learning in that level. So it was so beautiful to see the children playing together with the Simon Bolivar Orchestra. having the support, the complete support of the community. This was raining, was cold, but the 8,000 people, they were there listening, enjoying music in the best level, because we were with a very difficult program. Beethoven Third, an open air venue.
I can still hear the cold, well, the cold winds of Rapplach in your voice. Feel.
Well, that is the thing. That is the beautiful responsibility. Sometimes we expect for the people to come to us. Sometimes we have to go to people. So what a beautiful thing is that now, for the Rapplach community, music is a symbol of hope.
You make it sound like marrying the first girl you ever kissed. That everything is a voyage of discovery. The naivety is preserved because you're discovering the whole world together through life.
It's like that, yes. As a citizen of the world, as somebody like all of us, responsible for the future of the world, we have to fight, we have to work for the future generations to have a better ideas about how the world can work. I can do what I know, that is music. Other people will do with medicine, with anything. I think we have to go back, let's say, to Greece, antique Greece. Art was something primordial in the first level of life of people, the sensibility, the ideas. Idea in the big conception of ideas. You don't have to be an intellectual to understand beauty or to enjoy a good symphony. Music, art, open to you new doors. It's a little bit crazy to think in that way, but I think it's the most powerful way to change things. Crazy, but maybe possible.
The man you call maestro, José Antonio Abreu, started El Sistema with the idea of taking children off the streets after school and put them to play in orchestras. Mm-hmm. The original slogan was play and fight.
Yes, still is our.
What does that mean?
To fight, to build their life, to build their life through music. I think Maestro Abreu is an angel, somebody that is giving his life, his complete life, for an idea, for a collective idea.
It's such an unusual combination. A musician who became an economist, mm-hmm. member of parliament, mm-hmm. All of these things together, and at the same time physically quite frail, not a healthy man, but probably saved 300,000 children.
Well, but look, he's blessed. He has a special, you know, energy, you know.
Tell me about the first time you met him.
Wow.
You were how old?
I was like 8 years old. And I saw this guy with big glasses. He was young at that time. Maybe, let's say, 50-something. And was amazing, so generous. He came and he said, he offered instruments for us because we didn't have the instruments. Then their instruments arrived. We were like, wow, it's true, it's happening, it's great. And we have a great relation. We have a very personal.
From when you were 8?
I was always close to him because I was always asking things about music, about life. And then I became his pupil in 1998, I think.
You say he was like a father?
It's like my father, yes. For all of us, naturally, when you are part of the family, you get a little piece of Abreu in your body. He can look fragile, but it's not. It's incredible how he works. He works the double of what I work, or the triple. It's really amazing. And he really have faith. That is something that also we are missing in our times.
What kind of faith?
He really believes that music can be a key to change. We are talking about something really huge, hundreds of thousands of children. You have to be a priest You have to really work. And Maestro Abreu is the head of all of that, but he's still dreaming and thinking. It will be beautiful one day to see one day in the life of Maestro Abreu, because you will get at the end of the day like, please, Maestro, let's go to rest. No, no, no. Now we have to go to the next rehearsal.
You were an only child. Mm-hmm. Were your parents not a little bit jealous that you became also a child of Abreu?
No. When I moved to Caracas, I was 16 years old. I was a teenager. And Maestro, she told my parents and my grandparents that I will take care of him. Don't worry. So he was like in charge, and they were agreed. He has been a father. You can be sitting 5 minutes with Maestro, and then you learn thousands of things. Because always a conversation with him is like Platon sitting with, you know, his pupils talking about life. He's a philosopher of life, Maestro Abreu. Amazing.
Your grandmother used to get up at 3 a.m. to take you to Caracas.
Yes,
to see him.
Yes, it's true.
And she bought you your first baton.
Yes.
Was there never any time where you thought, do I need to go to rehearsal today? I want to go and kick a ball. I want to go and chase a girl. Were you never a little bit rebellious against this feeling?
No.
I want to have?
No. No, because the orchestra was for me, you know, also part of my free time, let's say. The time that I want to enjoy. I was always around my friends that they were in the orchestra. We were having fun in rehearsals, in the middle of a class, and then the rehearsal, we were playing soccer, or baseball, or something like that. So it was really natural. Still is the same. Still is the same. I think the orchestra became what is the orchestra, what is el sistema? A family. When you see the interaction of the members of the orchestra, it's amazing because you see them as a family. Mm-hmm. It's nothing professional. Even they don't think as a professional thing. You know, when they say, you know, my colleague or something like that, they don't call them, between them, colleagues. They call, like, you know, my friends. The union. You feel that in the sound of the orchestra. When they play, people ask me, when they move together, do you rehearse that? No, we don't rehearse that. It's part of the natural.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Because if not, that will look no natural and will not sound natural. So the thing is that everything what happened is so natural.
The friends of yours from school who didn't join the orchestra, you grew up in quite a violent society.
Mm-hmm.
What happened to the ones who didn't join?
Well, I have some friends that they are working, they are having a good life. Others, they went in the other way. Sadly, some of them, you know, they got killed, you know, problems. I'm really proud where I grew up, you know. For me, it's part of my inspiration for every day, you know, for my life. I have a good memory and remember things really clear. For me, it was so important to be part of that community. 1.5 years ago, I went to La Organización Sucre, that is the name. And you know what was the beautiful thing of that? I went there, I went to visit the apartment where I was living. Then the community came, and almost all the children, they came with instruments. They came with instruments. And for me, it was like, wow. I feel really proud of them.
In a society like Venezuela, which has a revolutionary government, and where El Sistema is claimed by the Chavez government as one of its successes, mm-hmm. how does Sistema and you manage to stay out of politics?
Well, but you know, music is so far from politics. I love the power of the music. When you go to a concert in Venezuela, you see people sitting there having different ideas, political ideas, and they sit together. It's a moment of union. Mm-hmm. Music represents union. And that, again, is so powerful. We can see the power of music that can put people together. People maybe that in another place, they will argue, they will fight, then they are sitting, and it's a moment of union. We live in a moment of human crisis. We need things that can help society to breathe, to feel that it's still hope, because we are living a very pessimistic moment. The world is collapsing. Wars, people not having access to food, everything. We have to rethink life. The things that we think are not important, we have to put them in the important level. When it's a big crisis, the first thing that sometimes people caught is culture. Mm-hmm. And that is something crazy to think. If you think what arts can give to society is something more powerful than what we think. In El Sistema, I've become a symbol of our country. Not only of Venezuela, of the continent. El Sistema is a symbol, you know. The citizens of Venezuela, they feel proud of what Sistema has become a flag of the country. And for us, it's amazing and it's great because music in Venezuela became a right. It's in the constitution.
Every child has a right to learn an instrument.
The right to learn music. It's an example. It's really an example of what we can do.
You conducted Mahler for the first time at 16.
16.
That must be a record. At 22, you go to Europe and you start to work with Claudio Abbado, Simon Rattle, Daniel Barenboim. I think every young conductor wants to know, how do you get to do that?
No, I think, my life has been so natural, Norman.
How did it happen?
I never have pushed myself. Yes, it was a challenge, especially to conduct Mahler when you are a teenager. Because, of course, you can move your arms, you can move your hands, you know, things will sound. But it's not easy to have a conception of a piece as difficult as is a Mahler symphony, as complex in feelings, in musical elements, in technical elements. That, for me, was a challenge. It was a challenge for all of us, because it's still almost the same group.
Okay.
We were, you know, fighting and dreaming to play these symphonies. When we play now in Los Angeles, all the symphonies, we said, wow, you remember? And it was not such a long time ago. We are talking about 10 years ago when we were starting to work with the Fifth Symphony, to read the Seventh, some movements and everything. And now the orchestra is recording Mahler symphonies, playing the symphonies around the world. And, you know, interpretations became more mature. But our goal is not to play the concert. Yes, we want to play the concert. But our main goal is to understand what we do.
You get a little sense of this when I see you in rehearsal with mm-hmm. them and in concert.
Yeah.
That you're constantly challenging each other to go one step higher.
Yes. And that is important in what we do. For everybody have to be like that. In any profession, you know, things is an evolution. It's a process of an evolution, very powerful evolution.
So you come to Europe. Did Maestro Abreu make introductions for you to conductors in Europe? Did he introduce you to Claudio Abbado? Or?
Well, Abbado came to Venezuela in 1999, mm-hmm. I think, yes. And Maestro Abreu introduced me to Abbado. Sinopoli, I remember. We were in a tour with the orchestra. I met Rattle. I met Barenboim in Venezuela in 2001, I think. And yes, you know, Maestro Abreu have, well, yes.
He opened a few doors.
Yes.
Yeah. And then you come to Bamberg, small town in Bavaria, and you win a competition that never existed before. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, overnight, the whole of the music business is buzzing.
Gustavo Dudamel, who is?
How did you know how to steer clear of the sharks and the snakes and everybody who was trying to get hold of you?
It was funny because I remember I arrived to their room and I had catalogs of companies to represent me, you know. And I had like 5 lunch in one day, you know, before. But I thought, now being honest to you, I didn't expect to win. I was hoping to go back home early because I was in Berlin with Rattle for a long period. And for me it was long, you know, to be out of Venezuela, of my home. I was thinking, how can I be sick to stay here? And then I won. And still for me, I don't know how I won the competition. And people, of course, flying around me to catch my attention.
You went to Gothenburg in Sweden.
Yes.
With Ed Smith, who was manager there, who had formerly been Simon Rattle's partner in Birmingham. And basically, that was to learn the repertoire with a very good orchestra, but somewhere out of the limelight. Yes, was that the idea?
Well, the Gothenburg Orchestra is a great orchestra.
Fantastic.
And it's our
orchestra. And very tough musicians, very stringent.
Tough musician, but also with a big reputation in the Nordic world of orchestras. With the background of Järvi, was like 22 years.
Nemi Järvi, that's
Nemi
right.
Järvi was conducted for 21, 22 years, the orchestra. And then Mario Benzago for a period. Then they called me, and we were doing a lot of repertoire, a lot of important repertoire. It's a risk to have a young conductor. You don't know what will happen, you know, experience, especially for an orchestra of a tradition with Sibelius, Nielsen, and all of this repertoire. But they say, well, let's do Sibelius, let's do Nielsen, let's do Bruckner, Mahler, Strauss. And it was great. When I think and I go back in these 5 years, what an amazing time. What an amazing time. Great orchestra, great family. They will be always my orchestra.
And then Los Angeles, the biggest reception an incoming conductor has received in America since Toscanini. Everybody calling you the dude. And you're on bus stops and on enormous posters. Weren't you a bit daunted or embarrassed by the razzmatazz?
We don't have time to think in that, you know. I'm always rehearsing, I'm always studying, I'm always with the family. It's beautiful to have the recognition of people because it's recognition to classical music, you know. If he's a pop artist, it's different, but for a classical musician, it's not easy. And if he's a way to help classical music to arrive to a new audience, it's wonderful. I don't feel change in my life. I know that I now live between LA and Caracas. I have a great orchestra, a great hall, a great team to work in Los Angeles, also in Caracas. I had in Gothenburg. When I'm thankful to life to conduct the best orchestras and to do the repertoire that I want to do. If I'm famous, if the people call me the dude or something like that, it's great, it's fun, but it's not as important as the music and the message of the music. So if that helps, great.
Is there a religious faith underneath this, Gustavo, when you say you give thanks?
I believe in God, yes. And I'm coming from a Catholic family. I grew up in a Catholic school. And of course, I believe in God, Jesus. And it's part, I think it's very important for people to believe in whatever we believe, but to believe. And it's beautiful because as a musician, sometimes, especially as a conductor, that you don't play on an instrument, if not the instrument is the orchestra, always that you are thinking, creating a sound when you are reading the score or studying. It's wonderful when you have that moment of sound inside, you know. And I think that is a beautiful contact to God.
The big composers in your life, Mahler, Beethoven, now Bruckner, Is there room for new music?
Yes, a lot, a lot of room. I just, like 3 weeks ago, I conducted the premiere of John Adams' new oratorium, Gospel According to the Other Mary, a long piece of like 2 hours and a half. I just brought with the Simon Bolivar the premiere of the Vensecri piece. I think it's very important. We have a big responsibility with the new generation of composers to bring their music to the people.
That's responsibility, but in terms of your feeling, your engagement with it?
I enjoy it completely. For me, conducting the young piece was one of the most amazing moments in my life, really. An amazing piece, very difficult, but such a beautiful music. And the same with the Esteban music that I premiered years ago, like 3 years ago, but still it's modern. And I hope to keep working for that. I have many premieres, Goodbye to Lina, Hilburg, many music.
You opened in Los Angeles with this globally televised performance of Mahler's First. You were the same age as Mahler was when he wrote it.
Yes, it's true.
This winter, you conducted a cycle of the Mahler symphonies, split between Los Angeles and Caracas, with the two orchestras, bringing it together between two countries, the United States and Venezuela, that are hardly on speaking terms. What were you trying to convey with Mahler in this way?
Well, Mahler have been really close to my life. But you know, it was a big challenge. It was a beautiful thing to see my two orchestras playing the different symphonies and then to play together the Eighth and to see how they were interacting in the best way.
And for the Eighth, you had 1,400 performers? 1,600.
1,600. Was a beautiful challenge. I don't know if I have a objective reason of why I conducted and I did in that way. I think both orchestras, they play different after the Mahler project. Los Angeles got a lot from the Bolivars, and the Bolivars got a lot from Los Angeles, and that was beautiful. That is really, really something very special.
Watching you with the two orchestras, I saw something that I haven't seen before with the conductor and orchestras, and it was with both of them. Where other conductors give gesture to an orchestra and receive music in return, you expect the gesture to be returned. You want it to be mirrored back at you by the faces of the players in a kind of ping-pong of mutual enthusiasm. Is that something you're aware of?
Absolutely, because that have to be like that. You know, for a conductor, you cannot expect to be in one point and know to receive something, only the sound, no. You have to receive the energy, the feelings. It's a ping-pong of feelings.
You're actually demanding more from the musicians, aren't you?
Well, I'm a pain for musicians. With this face that is smile all the time, I can be really, really demanding, really, really, until the last point. But I know that after that last point, we can go forward. And I try that in the best way. It's not like in a crazy way of pushing people, no. In the most natural, because I think in the moment when you really understand something, you really enjoy. Sometimes you have only 4 rehearsals. In that 4 rehearsals, more than to play together, that is to understand, to create an interpretation that all of us, we are happy with. When everybody is so connected, it's amazing what you create. Maybe it's not perfect. Maybe, you know, you have some little things, but the amount of energy, special energy that you receive, you feel really like happy. I'm very
But you want more than energy, you want emotion from the players.
Completely. I'm very autocritical in the way how I conceive things sometimes, all the time, sorry. But sometimes you have to understand that you have in front of you people that think and that have ideas. Sometimes we, especially young conductors, we want to impose things. And that is not the right way. And I know that because I have been learning for years, you know, conducting the orchestras, children, youth orchestra, professionals in my country. It's so important that you respect what they have. I think it's the most respectful way, not only for the orchestra, for the music, and for you.
One of the ideas that Deborah Border had in bringing you to Los Angeles was to engage with the huge, marginalized, largely underprivileged Latino minority in that city, to reach out to the barrios. Mm-hmm. Is that working?
It's working.
How?
A lot. Now we are going for our third orchestra in 3 years.
Third orchestra from the Latino community.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's not only Latin, you know. We have Afro-American people, Latin, Asian people. It's really multicultural. Simon Rattle was conducting the orchestra like 3 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. He was there conducting Los Angeles Philharmonic, and he conducted the last movement, a little arrangement, last movement of Beethoven Fifth. And they sound so great, you know. They have improved, not only in their life, because you see their parents sitting at the Disney Hall, listening to their children playing, you know, Beethoven and all of that, and they feel so proud of that, and they are like, wow, thank you for this. But also, in the artistic level, they are improving, they believe now. At the beginning was a game, you know, but now for them is something serious. That is such a beautiful thing. It's working, it's really working, and also I'm really so proud of our team, of our educational team, because they have understood what is the system about. It's not simple. Sometimes people want to start big, and you cannot start big. You have to start small to go for big things.
Gustavo, when you look at something like America's Got Talent, mm-hmm. Britain's Got Talent, and you contrast it with the organic work that you're doing with children, and the offer of instant fame, mm-hmm. overnight fame, that these media shows give. How does that make you feel?
You know, I think, with all the respect, that is something no helpful for society. Because sometimes you can think that you can be famous in 1 second. We don't have the right amount of time to learn that we have to work for things. And we see fame now like that, but it's not the only way. We cannot compare with El Sistema, because El Sistema is such a different thing. In El Sistema, you learn to be successful together as a team. In the moment that you are successful as a team, you are successful as an individual. But what a beautiful thing when you are sharing and you are building something as a big group, as a team. That is what is the Bolívar about. And it's not that I'm Gustavo Dudamel, no. I'm another member of the Simón Bolívar Orchestra, completely. And it's something like an example how we have to work as a society. We have to believe, we have to destroy borders. And how we do? Well, we do with music. We do with the orchestra.
Gustavo Dudamel, muchas gracias.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Herman.
Norman Lebrecht was talking to the conductor Gustavo Dudamel. The Lebrecht interview was produced by Paul Frankel. You'll be able to listen to the programme again via the Radio 3 website, and it'll also be available there to download as a podcast. Well, next week, Norman Lebrecht will be talking to the great pianist Menachem Pressler. That's the Lebrecht interview next Monday evening at the slightly later time of 10 o'clock.
9 symphonies that changed music forever. On Radio 3, Beethoven at the BBC Proms. All 9 symphonies, conducted by Daniel Barenboim, across a week of concerts from London's Royal Albert Hall, culminating with the composer's Hymn to Universal Brotherhood, the Choral Ninth. Beethoven, conducted by Barenboim at the BBC Proms, starting Friday night on BBC Radio 3.
Well, back to this evening and some informal words and music from the Proms. Petrock presents some recordings from the past weekend in a couple of minutes. And before that, some more musical Americana from that Michel Legrand disc that I dipped into earlier. Lasting just over a minute, this is a prelude for piano composed in 1935 by Conlon Nancarrow. It was short. That was a prelude for piano by Conlon Nancarrow, born 100 years ago this year. Michel Legrand was the pianist. What effect does the physiology of composers' hands have on the music that they write? Beethoven had heavy and muscular hands, Weber had very long thumbs, and Chopin's hands were so elastic and flexible that one of his pupils said they resembled the opening mouth of a serpent about to swallow a rabbit whole. Ian Burnside considers the idea of how hands, fingers, thumbs and their use have affected Western keyboard composition next weekend in a feature called The Hands of the Composer. That's on Saturday lunchtime at 12:15. On BBC Radio 3, it's 10:30, time for poetry and jazz at the Proms, recorded on Saturday night and introduced by Petrock Trelawney.
Welcome to the Elgar Room here at the Royal Albert Hall, the Proms late night space, where tonight we welcome a performance poet from North London who shared the stage with some of the most distinguished names in her field. Zina Edwards will be on stage very shortly. First of all, music from the winner of the Rising Star category at the 2008 British Jazz Awards and the Future in Jazz Award of 2010. Freddie Gavita is a trumpeter and composer. We welcome him with Kit Downs at the piano, Shane Thorbs drum kit, bassist Dave O'Brien. Ladies and gentlemen, the Freddie Gavita Quartet.
Thank you. Good evening. So, are there any hopeless romantics in here who believe in love at first sight? I based this piece on the whole concept of a waltz. So it's kind of got that 3-4 vibe. And it's called Meet. And that's M-E-E-T. Just want to stress that. Yes. Chapter 1. Meets. His eyes, her eyes, and worlds collide. Chapter 2, hormones, they tangle, they sparkle, they spangle, they make love at all angles. Open wide, landslide, down this abyss, to bliss, they chant their love business. In song, can't be wrong for this long, this long. It's 3 weeks. Is this love? Oh, this love, baby. 'Cause it's so sweet when pairs of eyes meet, it's a blue sky, cloudless, like silence is loudness, some feeling needed and heeded, like hunger for cooked food. Man, where did you come from? Chapter 3. She's strong, he's strong, tight love, bound tight, right love, it sounds right, this love at first sight, fearless, they trust in this newness, they're naked and touching what's sacred, but she woman and he man, Mars and Venus, uterus and penis, rule head and heart different, yet both claim genius. Rocks thrown at glass houses, rough tones in loud voices, love damned, door slammed, all this for power, love argues for hours, or violence in silence like sliced ice, defiance, emotions, such turbulent oceans. Chapter 4. Can't sleep. I won't sleep. I keep peeping time so deep, those fluffy flashbacks that crack. Rejected, dejected, distance, distance, SOS, in distress, running round and round and round and round like chickens that are headless. But this mess is blessed, though, just complex like chess. So when they meet, his eyes, her eyes, both hungry inside to heal, to seal a deal, to speak and feel what's real. Chapter 5. Truth sighs, a sunrise. Chapter 6. Honesty, seasons reason, like winds reason seasons to heart song. So hold on. Hold on, not long now. Know that it's fact that strong love is hard work. But a strong tree loves hard the earth. That's me.
Thank you.
Freddy Gavita Quartet, ending the first of the season's Proms Plus Lates. And you also heard the poet Zena Edwards reading her poem Meet. Now, just before the essay, Donald MacLeod looks ahead to Thursday night's prom.
On Radio 3, from the BBC Proms, Handel's dramatic oratorio Judas Maccabeus. A morale-boosting tale of military prowess which proved even more popular in the composer's time than his Messiah. A distinguished lineup of Handelians from our own time is headed by John Mark Ainsley. The BBC Proms, live from the Royal Albert Hall. Thursday night at 7:30 on BBC Radio 3.
That's Jazz with Jez in 15 minutes here on Radio 3 after the first of this week's essays. This week, in a series called Under the Influence, three artists working in different forms reveal some of their influences. First, the musician John Bowden, best known for his work with the folk big band Bellowhead.
If you happen to be my age or a little older, you will probably remember The Tripods, BBC One at 6 on Saturday nights. Here was a world that had regressed to a medieval existence, utopian in its lack of conflict, in the simplicity of its lifestyle. Wars and crime had been eradicated by enormous, three-legged metal gods who arrived in your village once a year to receive the village's teenagers and to cap them in order to bring them into line with the bucolic, peaceful existence of their elders. Now, of course, that's no way to live. And our heroes enter the underground, resisting the brainwashing of their demonic overlords and fighting for the freedom of the human spirit. Hurrah! And yet, there was always a part of me that wondered whether they mightn't have been better off leaving well alone, just enjoying the simplicity of the life that was imposed upon them. Later on, I read the original Tripods novels by John Christopher and realised that this moral ambiguity was a not insignificant element of the original creation. This led me on to his other trilogy, The Prince in Waiting, again set in a regressed future where machines and electricity were prescribed dark arts, rigidly repressed by the all-powerful theocracy. Here, our hero brings technology back, and even more so than in The Tripods, it is not entirely clear whether in doing so he becomes the hero or the villain. Despite being generally filed under the rather off-putting categories of science fiction, or even worse, teenage fiction, I was drawn to books of this ilk as a young reader. The Changes trilogy by Peter Dickinson, in which all inhabitants of England develop a phobia of technology. Z for Zachariah by Robert O'Brien, set after a nuclear disaster. After London by Victorian botanist Richard Jennings. All books that in one way or another explored what we stood to lose in the event of technological meltdown, but also what we stood to regain. These days I make a living as a folk musician. I play traditional English folk music and sing traditional English folk songs. Generally, we're talking about material that is about 200 years old, material that may once have had a single composer, but that has been passed around, musician to musician, singer to singer, for decades, sometimes for centuries, until its origins have been long forgotten and the process of oral transmission has meant a word lost here, a new melodic flourish there, until the material is no longer the domain of a single composer, but the product of collective authorship. This is what people call, perhaps rather grandly, the tradition. I prefer to think of it as a long-term game of Chinese whispers, a collective creative process that is, incidentally, explored in many post-apocalyptic novels, most notably in Russell Hoban's Ridley Walker, in which a half-remembered form of the Punch and Judy puppet play assumes a religious status. In folk music, the result of this process is material that gravitates towards simple, direct, gnomic expression, rather than the more artful but often more self-conscious forms of the individual poetic voice. When I was about 14, a friend of my parents noted my growing teenage obsession not only with post-apocalyptic literature, but also with Led Zeppelin's folkier albums, and handed me a bootleg recording of Martin Carthy's Prince Heathen. Where Zeppelin hinted at a rural aesthetic not dissimilar to that of The Tripods, or After London, albeit shrouded behind the screaming guitar solos, here was that aesthetic in a simple, bold, direct form. Just voice and guitar and the odd flourish of fiddle.
Lady stands in a garden fair, sewing a silken seam, and by and come this princey, then, and he vowed her love he'd gain. Oh, lady, will you weep for me? Lady, tell me true, I'll never yet you heathen dog, and never shall for you.
Some years later, I was handed another bootleg, this time by the even more sonically abrasive folk singer Peter Bellamy. Bellamy was a strange mixture of traditionalist and iconoclast, someone who aspired only to pure acoustic expression of traditional song, but whose real musical obsession was in fact with the Rolling Stones. A provocative singer and performer, but capable of moments of real tenderness and reflection. I wasn't at all keen on his voice to begin with, but gradually my antipathy gave way to mild interest and then, quite suddenly, to obsession.
By a shiny green bough, I sat myself down, where the bird songs are gaily enchanting all round, in the forest of happy Australia, in the forest of happy Australia. Where the maidens are handsome and gay.
Bellamy has been at the core of my musical life ever since. For me, he managed to codify a range of singing techniques and melodic and editorial approaches to traditional song which have informed most of what I've done since, from my involvement with experimental big band Bellowhead to my current attempt to record a simple version of a different folk song every day for a year on the afolksongaday.com podcast.
So come, wind, blow the clouds away, and tell
I have no problem in justifying the artistic merit of folk music. It is, in the words of Kazuo Ishiguro, a treasure trove, a hoard of beauty and entertainment belonging to anyone resident in this country wishing to claim their stake in the common ownership of the tradition. It entertains, it delights, it excites, and yet there is this nagging doubt at the back of my mind that for all its strengths, for all its expressive weight, is it also the case that what we professional folk musicians are peddling is comfort food? Heritage knick-knacks to please the middle classes, chocolate box vignettes of an old England that never really existed. If folk music is so good, then why do people not make it for themselves anymore? Why do they have to rely on a specialised elite to provide a vacuum-packed, airbrushed version of a music that was once made by the people for the people? Is there any real difference to what we offer and what A Night in Front of the Soaps offers? I do not accept this view, but that is what the little Walt Disney cartoon devil perching on my shoulder whilst I perform will occasionally whisper into my unguarded ear. Or at least it used to be. But a few years ago, I found a rejoinder to stump the most stubborn demon. Like many people in their late 20s, I took that final leap into adulthood and became a father. Like all new parents, the axis of my world shifted so that now at its centre was this new life, a baby girl who might conceivably live to see the 22nd century. Now, every time the news mentioned the imminent crises awaiting mankind, ravages of climate change, the rise of sea levels in 50 years' time, the paradoxical probability of an ice age to herald the eventual global drought, the problem of peak oil, and the ensuing global fracas of billions of drug addicts clawing for their last carbon fix, the last drop of oil before we face the deadly pangs of withdrawal. These anxieties already at the back of my mind were now brought into fresh focus by the arrival of the innocent, unknowing babe in arms, who had nothing to do with the making of the problems, but would like as not live to see their fruition, when my generation would be safely tucked up in our coffins. These morose thoughts were only occasional bouts, arguably brought about as much by the sleep deprivation of new fatherhood as by anything else. But these thoughts did occupy my mind now and then, and I found myself thinking, what if the oil taps are switched off? Not in a theoretical, distant future, but in my daughter's lifetime, or even in mine. After all, it will happen a long time before we actually run out of oil. As soon as there is a scarcity, people, governments, corporations will start hoarding the stuff. And it won't be long before it's either unavailable or, perhaps more likely, unaffordable for the many. So what will happen? Will there be riots? Will the democratic order of the nation fracture and emergency rule be imposed? Will we bequeath a dystopian nightmare to our children? But then again, what if that didn't happen? What if, as a nation, we were to succeed in weaning ourselves off the addiction to the black drug and rediscover the ability held by all generations throughout history, other than our own and our parents, to exist without oil? No cars, no electricity for unnecessary things like television or Xboxes or Facebook. Might that not, I found myself thinking, be rather a good thing? Might it not lead to neighbour talking to neighbour, people visiting their local, old men and women sitting on park benches for a gossip rather than in front of the box? Might, in short, we find ourselves in the world of John Christopher's The Prince in Waiting, a regressed future, but perhaps none the worse for it. And might it not be the case that people in a world without easy access to oil and electricity might find that they need to make their own entertainment, their own music, their own song, their own theatre, their own rituals to punctuate the slowly changing seasons. In short, might it not be that what they need then is folk culture? And when the television screens all go black and the pub jukeboxes go quiet, it is precisely the facility for communal expression afforded by folk music that people will look for. A facility that is being kept quietly ticking over by folk clubs, folk sessions, folk festivals and folk musicians up and down the country. It's a difficult thing to talk about without sounding like some eco-fatalist cult member, and that awkwardness makes me think that maybe I've just been reading too much post-apocalyptic fiction, which, to be fair, I have. Most recently, the brilliant Year of the Flood by Margaret Atwood, and Klaas Ostergren's beautiful but deeply strange The Hurricane Party. Then, of course, there is The Road by Cormac McCarthy, which I read in one sitting, in tears mostly. Brilliant, but I'm not sure I'd read it again. So maybe I should just get out more. But I am heartened to note that I'm not the only folkie to find myself edging towards this territory. The only original song written by the great traditional singer Nick Jones is The Haunting Ruins by the Shore. Peter Bellamy's primarily traditional output was similarly augmented by Al Stewart's Nostradamus, and even Martin Carthy has been drawn towards vague glimpses of a future meltdown. So not only are folk singers preserving material for future usage, but perhaps we are also drawn to contemplate that future scenario itself. A couple of years ago, that impulse led me to a sudden flurry of songwriting that resulted in my album Songs from the Floodplain, a song cycle considering a dystopian future. I've since put a band together to perform the material alongside traditional songs, and we have played all over the country, including last year at the Dark Mountain Festival, an entire weekend devoted to contemplation of a technologically regressed future, bringing together poets, musicians, scientists, and artists. These creative outpourings seem to me to be part of a broader artistic movement slowly gathering momentum. A movement that is joining with the long-established literary tradition of post-apocalyptic fiction, but that is reinvestigating those themes less as a polemical warning to readers or listeners to mend their ways, but more as a contemplation of where we are going, what we stand to lose, and more significantly, what we stand to gain. It seems to me right and proper that these sorts of issues should be the province of artists, whether novelists, filmmakers, poets, or songwriters. Politicians have to pander to our collective denial of the journey we are inexorably sliding towards or risk being punished at the polls. Scientists have to shun any creative use of the imagination in their presentation of climate science or risk giving ammunition to the climate change denying lobby. Artists have the freedom to confront these issues and to plant ideas into the collective imagination of the nation. Folk musicians are as much part of that process as any, and in confronting these issues, we also bring to bear the preserved memories of our ancestors, reminding us that once we sang, danced, and played together, and that we can do so again.
John Bowden, singer and fiddle player with Bellowhead. In tomorrow night's essay, the choreographer Shobana Jayasinghe, who was born in India, is based in Britain and makes dance seen all around the world, considers two important influences on her work. These essays were first broadcast in April last year.
One reviewer called it the most consistently adventurous part of the prom season. On BBC Radio 3, Saturday matinees at the BBC Proms, a series of four concerts across the season that this year juxtapose ancient and modern. Sir Roger Norrington recreates the legendary ensemble of 24 violins that perform for Louis XIV. The Britain Symphonia and Birmingham Contemporary Music Group present the music of some of the United Kingdom's greatest living composers. And in the first concert, harpsichordist Mahan Esfahani performs his new arrangement of Bach's The Art of Fugue. Saturday matinees from the BBC Proms, here on Radio 3 from 3 o'clock.
And presented by Christopher Cook. This is BBC Radio 3 on 90 to 93 FM on digital radio and online. From 12:30, this music through the night with me, John Shea. But now it's just after 11 o'clock and time for this week's Jazz on 3 with Jez Nelson.
Take a selection of Europe's most exciting young bands, mix them up in a brand new festival of high energy music, light blue touch paper, and retire.
There's a great spirit in Europe. Perhaps it could be the beginning of a new wave of sort of energy.
That's Dave Moorcroft of the British Quintet, the World Service Project, a prime example of the explosive new European music showcased at the Match and Fuse Festival, and we've WSP doing their thing very soon. Also on stage were palindrome-loving Irish quartet Redivider. I'll give you just a second to think about that. Wordplay-loving Redivider bring together a blend of grooves and freely improvised music, and we've their set later on in the show. Firstly, though, music from a new release by another young band with a good deal of attitude, a group called United Vibrations, who played on one of our London Jazz Festival live shows a couple of years ago. A very young group. I think the drummer was about 12 at the time, and they sort of mix up Afrobeats, funk, and some Sun Ra influences. Well, they've got a brand new EP out, and it includes this mashup of John Coltrane and the Dalai Lama. It's called Oh What Giant Steps.
Oh,
the atom, but not our prejudice.
Oh, what giant steps!
We've conquered outer space, but not yet inner space.
Oh, what giant steps!
We've been all the way to the moon and back, but have trouble crossing the street to meet the new neighbor.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
From South London, I believe. That's a lot of fun, I think. United Vibrations and Oh What Giant Steps. And their new EP is out on 12 Tone Records, released today. And they're certainly a band that wouldn't have been out of place at the first Match and Fuse Festival, put on over 2 days, inside and outside the Vortex in North London last month. 13 bands from Scandinavia, the Netherlands, France, Italy and more. The billing was loaded with bands with heavy electronic sounds, thrashy, punky influences to the fore. And our first set tonight is from World Service Project, who I guess really epitomised that approach. They've been described as skronk jazz, post-punk prog funk, and a four-way cage match between Frank Zappa, Weather Report, Stravinsky, and Meshuggah. If you don't know who Meshuggah are, I didn't. They're a Swedish extreme metal band. Well, we featured World Service Projects on Jazz on 3 as a BBC introducing act early last year, and on the evidence of this gig, they're really developing. They're led by Dave Moorcroft, who also devised the whole Match and Fuse event, and before they played, Dave spoke to our man on the ground, Marcus O'Dair, who spent the afternoon taking the atmosphere down at Gillette Square in North London.
Well, there's a man doing a headstand as we speak. There's also children cartwheeling, there's burgers and beer, lots of people sitting on the ground and sitting at tables outside. It does not a sight that you normally see at an English jazz event, definitely not here in Dalston. And we're going to go and see just what people make of it.
Was here all yesterday and most of today. Have been really interesting and some really good stuff.
What did you think?
I've enjoyed everything I've heard, but for me it's a bit too loud, but it's expanding my ideas of jazz, so I'm interested to hear other things from other countries for a change.
I like the rocky jazz kind of stuff, the stuff that kind of breaks the norm that we expect from jazz, really. That's the benefit of having things like this go on. We're introduced to a lot more stuff that we wouldn't necessarily know of otherwise.
It's wonderful music, played beautifully with thought and listening. It's inspiring.
We've dragged Dave Moorcroft back into the Vortex office in the middle of a bustling festival organising operation. He is, of course, the composer and keyboard player in World Service Project, but he's also the person that came up with the idea of Match and Fuse. Dave, what is the idea?
For me, the original vision was to try and connect up all of those sort of creative pockets of cutting-edge artistry you can find around Europe. And I think it's very difficult as an audience member or as a musician to discover this kind of music. You know, in the UK, we might talk about Leadbeard or Trio VD or people like that. Outside of the UK, I think it would be very difficult to find those bands unless you were very specifically connected somehow to, you know, something that's very specific to that scene.
The acts are kind of more or less jazz acts. There seems to be a kind of, I don't really like the word, but there seems to be a kind of prog element to it too. But how would you define the common theme that brings together all the acts you've got over the 2 days?
I just really like them. No, but I think for me there's been two words or two phrases which was cutting edge explosive music, as you say, with maybe like a jazz center point, but then using these other styles around it to kind of create this very interesting mix of jazz but with contemporary styles, electronica, punk. In no way do I ever want to or want people to kind of put this label on it, because in a way Match and Fuse is supposed to be both the idea of the concept of matching and fusing the bands, but the concept of matching and fusing audiences, styles, genres, you know, and creating something new.
We were together in Portugal earlier on in the year at the 12 Points Festival, and obviously this is a very European perspective to this festival as well. Do you think that's something that's growing, or has that European spirit always been there in jazz?
There's a great spirit in Europe where you have, because you've got all so many different cultural traditions. For example, when we did our Italian exchange and we went to Italy in May, and the way that a gig is run in Italy is just completely different from in the UK, and the way Italian musicians interact with each other, the kind of camaraderie they have, and you can travel for 2 hours on a plane and suddenly you have a completely different experience and a completely different way that music is viewed and listened to and played.
We're going to hear some World Service Projects in a minute. What do you want people to do when they hear this music? Because on the one hand, it sort of seems like people could dance to it, and then on the other hand, you probably start dancing and you tie your feet in knots, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I think teasing and flirting, that's something I find very interesting. And you know, you look all the way back to, like, for example, Joseph Haydn with this the Joke String Quartet, and Stravinsky kind of deliberately just suddenly destroying people's expectations of music. I think for me that's just absolutely incredible. I think if you can make someone get really into a groove, and then suddenly just when they've got into it, you just flash it away from them, and then you put something else. And maybe you want to dance, maybe you want to, you know, shout at the band. I don't know, anything like that. It's just where you're kind of breaking down that barrier between the stage and the second row. And it's still, you know, we're kind of moving into a new area now. I think we just recorded our second album, and that's something that's kind of at the center of our explorations, I think.
Dave, thanks for talking to us. Go and organise your festival.
Thanks very much. Thanks. Cheers.
Now, I want to welcome to the stage the guys who've made this all happen. I want you to give them a big applause, not for the music, not just for the music you're about to hear now. Of course that, but also the incredible amount of hard work and dedication they've put in making this happen. So please put your hands together for World Service Project.
Thank you.